do, we've got three remaining updates from this morning's session. We're going to welcome Equinix to present their update, JP Knapp to present their update, and then we're going to have Josh from Terramark presenting his update as well. So if we can have the Equinix guys in the room. Or have I started a bit too early? Oh yeah, Celia, hi.
Hi. Do you have slides?
Sure.
And while the slides are being set up, we're going to have the world premiere of the EuroIX film at this working group session, and some other slides on making your networks more attractive for peering. And we're also going to learn more about Equinix's new carrier exchange product. And we're also going to have an update from Serge on EuroIX, and we're going to have an update on the EuroIX root server project. So without further ado, here's Celia from Equinix.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, I'm Celia, working from Equinix. So Equinix with an E is in the afternoon session because we're not a European provider, we're a global provider. So thanks for that, actually. I will start my presentation with what people know about Equinix. We're a global data center provider. We operate 45 facilities in 18 metros worldwide. But what people don't know about Equinix is we're a global interconnection provider. We provide cross-connect internet exchange services, but also dedicated community of interest with financial exchange and so on. We operate 12 and a half internet exchange. Why half? I will explain that later. But basically, in every metro we've got data center, we can provide you with a connection to an internet exchange, whether it's an Equinix exchange or whether it's a partner exchange. This is a S-flow graph of internet exchange traffic volume worldwide. So you can see with the peak traffic at 368 gigabits of traffic. So what's Equinix Exchange? First of all, it's a global platform. Basically, it means if you're a global network, you can get a service consistent across all the countries. But even if you're not a global network, you can benefit for all the global features. So that includes a 24/7 help desk, technical support, S-flow statistic by peers, a metro performance information, including uptime statistics with jitter and latency information, as well as multilateral peering exchange, support for private VLANs, an innovative functionality is find a peer, and last but not least, the invitation to the Global Peering Forum. So I'm going to update on some partners exchange. So Lynx is available from Equinix Data Center in London 4 and London 5. Lots of space there. Some people said it's a bit far away, but actually it's not that far. There is some new connectivity option to central London that become available. If you have some question about them and you're interested, please come and see us. Some latency routes to central London, as well as some Europe and US cities, avoiding the central London. So some quite good to go to US and some Frankfurt or, basically, our goal is to make the SLA the next generation Ashburn of Europe. DKIX, available from Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, we've got quite a lot, 39 carriers in Frankfurt 1 facility, 35,000 square meters in Frankfurt 2, that's quite impressive. We've got Frankfurt 4 data center coming along with 9,000 square meters and 9 MVA of power. Not to forget to mention the Alpix available from Munich data center. Finally, AMZIX, which is available from the Amsterdam 1 data center. Amsterdam, Yes, we still have space available in Amsterdam. We've got Amsterdam 1 with 3,000 square meters and more to come. So don't be afraid to come to Amsterdam. So 0.5 partner exchange now. Why 0.5? It's because we co-manage the KXP with the CERN. So this cooperation started in 2000. It's present from Geneva One Data Center and CERN. And the Equinix and CERN came to an agreement in principle to extend to the Geneva 2 data center, which is coming early next year. An update on Equinix Exchange in Zurich. Some of you will know it as the TIX, Telaus Internet Exchange, located in Zurich 1 and Zurich 2, and expanding in Zurich 4, which is coming next year in Q2, sync with Equinix Global Standard. 62 connected member and the peak at 7 gig of traffic. Last but not least, Paris Equinix Exchange, one more. Available from Paris 2 and Telaus 2. We use a 410 X600i switches with warm spares at each site. We achieve a 3 gig of traffic peak. We've got 30 connecting members. Something I'd like to highlight are the pricing, because some people still don't know FastE and Gigi port are free from either Telaus or Paris Equinix data center. So just the install, 300 for FastE. Gigi, it's €500, and a 10 gig port is free until the end of 2010. Then it'll be charged $1,500. And that's it. Quite a lot.
Thank you. Well done. Any questions for Celia? No? Okay, then we're ready for the JPNAP update. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Katsuya Stoyama of JPNAP. So I quickly will talk about JPNAP. So JPNAP is an Japan Network Access Point, a commercial internet exchange in Japan, Ethernet-based layer 2 IX. And we are JPNAP, but sometimes people are confused with the JPNIC registry. We are not registry and internet exchange, so please don't ask me for IPv4 address space because we have only a thresh 24, okay? And we are three internet exchange in Japan, Tokyo 1 and Tokyo 2 and Osaka. Tokyo 1 is the biggest the traffic volume, approximately at 380 gigs at the peak. And Osaka is 500 kilometers from Tokyo. And these are independent network. That means that not interconnected. Okay. And the hot topic is Tokyo 1 expansion. A new POP was built in Equinix TY2. As Celia said, the Equinix is a global data center company. So if you are thinking about go into the Japan and especially in Tokyo, and please think about an Equinix and connect to the JPNAP. Okay. And JPNAP Tokyo 1 is concentrated in the center of the Tokyo, and this green one. And TY2 is approximately 10 kilometers from the center of the Tokyo. So we expanded our network to this point, and using the WDM and the dark fibers, okay? And we provided the same as the service spec to the ISPs. Main and the backend ports with an optical switch, and backbone itself is redundant. And we are providing the 10 gig and 1 gig E in a TY2. Okay. Oh, thank you very much. And the traffic graph is added. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? We're racing through the updates. Is Josh in the room? Hello, we're ready for TerraMark. Now, if Josh runs, if we run over time and miss the dinner, it's going to be Josh's fault. So,
yeah. I'm gonna go really slow.
Josh doesn't drink, so he's got no incentive.
What he means is I didn't drink before this. Snow one. Look for snow one. So guys, I'm actually going to present on our Istanbul Internet Exchange, which is a little bit of a different twist. Usually I talk about NAPA the Americas or different facilities. So we are actually opening a new exchange. Just a little bit about TerraMark globally. Our major exchanges are in Miami and Sao Paulo, Brazil, with a smaller one in Bogota. Most of the other data centers either house other exchanges or are hosting or colo sites. But if you have any questions about any one of those in details, we'll talk about that after. I want to talk about Turkey right now. So there's no internet exchange in Turkey right now, in Istanbul at all, and we're trying to actually create a regional hub. And what we did is we actually took space inside the Mediterranean Nautilus cablehead, so it's direct international access, but it is in Istanbul, so we'll have Turk Telecom and Super Online and all the big players there. But the idea is actually to create an aggregation hub where we can pull in Jordan, Syria, Israel, Iraq, Iran, unless you want to put a router in Iran, anybody? What? Ah, yes, Will, of course. You have routers? And we're actually going to have a Force 10 S-Series switches, two of them inside the facility. We're going to start out with Gigi just because we don't see anybody jumping into peering too quickly there, but 10 gig is coming up. We'll probably ship switches for that in like 6 months. So just some pictures of the colo. It actually is a decent colo, and it's a well-built site. Again, we have about 1,600 square meters with another 400 square meters we can actually build out to add capacity. So quick shot through the pictures. They have batteries. We don't use, TerraMark actually is a flywheel-based company, so we don't usually use batteries. So a little bit new for us in that sense. Security, camera system, FM200 gas system. Because it is a small site, we're able to do that. Quick summary, and I'm doing this quick because everybody seems to be giving me flack about going along here. So, SLAs, Force 10 peering switches, again, creating a hub for the Middle East. So if any of you are interested in trying to aggregate traffic or bring content there to pick up all the eyeballs, it's going to be a great location. The undersea cable, by the way, has a direct link to Haifa. So if you do want to pick up Bezek, it's going to be a great place to be able to do that. It's difficult in the Middle East to get, and really Turkey is, fitting both ways. Mehmet will tell you he's Turkish. It's really European and Middle Eastern at the same time, but it's the best aggregation hub where all of these countries will actually feel safe going into it. So now I have a problem. What kind of name? We actually haven't been able to figure out what to call our exchange there. So TIX, there's lots of TIXes, and sorry Equinix, I know you guys have a TIX, but it does sound like a blood-sucking insect, there's no question about that. BIX, Budapest Internet Exchange, it's a little too close. NAP of Turkey, I already have NAP of the Americas, I would have never called it that in the first place, but I didn't have that choice, it's kind of a sleepy name. Eurasrix, that's Kara's invention, so she might get credit, she's hoping. Now there's a list of other ones. I've had, TR-IX, that's Mehmet. Turkix has been several people. I'm waiting for a raise of hands, anybody telling me what to call this thing. You guys get to name an internet exchange, come on, and nobody's excited here. And then I've got Istix, and then I've got IIX, I-I-X, which just doesn't work, so. But anyway, names, what do you guys like, Turkix? Okay, now I want you to go look up turkix.net. Go look it up, turkix.net, whoever can do it. And then somebody tell me what it says on there. Just having fun with these name thing.
One word?
Am I out of time?
I was saying, I've just looked it up, but it says we're going to miss dinner.
Cara, did you look it up?
No.
No? Turkix.net, who looked that up? Here goes.
Okay, I'll read out the entire webpage for you. Turkix.net says, this is a test. No flesh shall be spared one.
See? So, yeah. Anyway, so there's danger in some of these names as well. But what do you guys think? Is it Turkix? Is that going to be the name for the exchange?
Tricks.
Or Istix? Tricks. Mehmet, the Turkish guy here, what do you think?
Tricks. Well, I started another one that was Pricks, so that might
Yeah. And we have Dominican Republic, so we have the dicks. We don't need anything more than that. But all right, so Turkix it is, but... What?
Tricks.
Tricks?
It's
Tricks.
The tricks. Yeah. All right. I'll give an announcement at the next EIX update, and we'll figure out what the name is and all that good stuff. And I'll give you guys traffic updates and everything else. But it does go live next month. If you have any questions, send it to me, and I'll help you out. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions other than naming issues? Okay. I think we're ready for Wolfgang, who's going to present a talk on making yourself more attractive appearing. Just while he's setting up, I think it's Sjord who's giving us technical support today, and Mark on the Jabber. I forgot to say thank you at the beginning. Thank you very much for agreeing to do those things, or you might have been forced to do those things, but thank you anyway.
The other one. Yeah, hello everybody. I am Wolfgang Tremmel, working for DKIX, and in my former life I was a peering manager. This presentation actually was conceived as a part of a peering tutorial we started this year for new customers. I adapted it slightly for this audience, but basically it's just the same. It's gone to several titles while I wrote it, like how to be a good peering manager, how to do peering procedures, and we stuck then with this one, which is how to make yourself attractive for peering. And the goal is, of course, to increase your peering success rate. May I ask a quick show of hands here who actually represents an ISP who does peer at one or other location? All right, thank you. Three basic rules for peering, or being good at peering. This is be available, know your network, and be professional. Be reachable and available. What does it mean? Your peers might want to contact you. They might want to contact you about the peering is full, or you have packet loss, or whatever. Or a network attack. Somebody might to say, hey, there's an attack coming from your network, please stop it. So what we're seeing down there, out there, is quite a lot of things that peers, ISPs who do peering, the only thing they might have is a phone number for their customers, or a phone number with a robot in their local language. Does that sound familiar? A lot of peers, a lot of good ones out there, they have a special web page for peering. Who has a web page dedicated for peering, stating peering policy or peering procedures of these ISPs? Four out of 50? Okay. And of course, that web page should be in English, as English is the language usually of choice when it comes to international peering. I have stated some examples here. Have a look, especially the first one. It's in German, but actually they do have an English link hidden somewhere at the bottom. Your peers should be, you should be reachable to your peers like your customers, meaning by email, by phone, by whatever. Usually the email address which is used is peering@. By phone, well, as I just said, we've seen robots requiring customer number. What customer number should a peer enter if he's telling you that you have a problem in your own network? And also, if there is a person answering that phone, make sure she knows what peering is. And if you do IP version 6 peering, be sure she knows also what IP version 6 is. You can publish that information in various ways. You can put it into the RIPE record, your AS record at the RIPE database. You have an entry for your AS anyway, why not use it? You can put it in PeeringDB. Who here has never heard of PeeringDB? That's good. Who has heard of PeeringDB? Okay. Check it out. It's free. have an example here of an entry in the RIPE database for AS5669. The entry is fine. It tells you where to send peering requests, where to send network problems, how to get corporate information or network information. Actually, I was the person putting that entry in there 6 years ago. I left that company 5 years ago. The entry is still there. It hasn't been touched for 5 years. So whatever you put into the, whatever you put there on information, how to contact you, please keep it up to date. It is worthless if it's 5 years old, and I guess that all of these URLs here or email addresses no longer work. Representing an internet exchange, of course, the internet exchanges have to know this as well. They might be contacted by other customers who are not able to get in touch with you, so we can help them. But if we are not up to date, we can't contact you either. We do publish a list of operational contacts for all of our customers, but if you don't update us when something changes, it doesn't make it on the list. Know your network. Who does know his own network really good? Usually it should be the peering manager. He should at least know where his peering points are and where he peers. The NOC manager should know where all the routers are. And both should know what they are announcing. Would you peer with these guys? I don't want to do blame and shame here, so I erased the first digit, but it looks like that somebody is just dumping all his internal routes into the global BGP table. So when I was peering manager, I had a pretty open peering policy, but one of the reasons I denied peering was that if someone was just doing deaggregation on a massive scale, he didn't get any peering. Make sure your BGP announcements are really clean. Aggregate. It doesn't have to have a 100% aggregation. Also, somebody might disagree with me here. So there might be reasons that you announce one or two more specifics, but do not announce all more specifics. And especially do not try to announce anything smaller than /24 if we talk about IP version 4. Also, most of you might have special customers with special needs, like internet cafes or gambling sites or whatever, which attract more traffic than they should do sometimes. So know who they are, know how to handle them if an attack is coming your way. Be professional. What does it mean, being a professional peering manager and handling peering in a professional way? How many of you peers here do have an open peering policy? Okay. How many of you have a restricted or policy-based peering policy? So please keep your hands now up. Who of you have published this peering policy? All right. That's good. That's better than I expected, about 5. Yeah, if peer talks to you and says, there's an attack, help me, what do you do? Do you do the correct choice? Talk to your customers, shut down your customer if he attacks someone, or block the bad packets, or do you just say, go away, I don't care? I've seen the first one quite often during my time. Document your peerings. If you have a look at the AS objects in the RIPE database, we've seen it this morning, I think, in another presentation, where somebody compared the peerings he saw on his exchange to the peerings documented in the RIPE database. This information is usually hopelessly outdated. Who here really keeps up his AS object with the peers he really has? four, five, six, seven, eight out of 50 people peering here. What's up with you? This is not professional. Also, if you announce maintenances on public mailing lists, is it on an exchange, or if you have your own mailing list, do it in English, please. Don't send Word attachments in your local language. Never, ever. We see this every other week on the DKIX, not on the DKIX mailing list, because we block attachments, but on our internal mailing list. People sending us a Word attachment with a subject, please open. Ah, yeah, another thing. We finally educated our customers not doing that anymore. The last point, do not announce every new prefix you are announcing, either publicly or privately to your peers. We know, because there is a thing like the RIPE database. Okay, this is now for the guys with the restricted peering policy. Like I said, please respond to every peering request. Even if it's a guy you know he will never peer with, just be polite. It's nice to be polite. Also, if he does not fulfill your requirements, give him a nice, no, we don't peer with you. Just don't say, go away and buy transit. I've heard that quite a lot of time, and I would never buy transit from somebody who is not nice to me. And if you deny it, and tell them why you denied them, so they can improve, they can grow, and even next year, if they fulfill your criteria, then you might peer with them. A word about peering contracts. The usual disclaimer here, I'm not giving any legal advice. I've experienced the topic of peering contracts quite often. At the beginning, when I took over the peering manager role, I forwarded each and every peering contract I received to our legal department. It took them 3 weeks usually, and they always had changes. I have no idea why they never can accept any contract coming from outside without changes, but that's the way it is. I see people smiling here. I'm sure everybody has experienced that. So to make your life easier, there are two things you can do. One is on the slide, the other one is not. The one is on the slide is ask the other party to sign your peering contract, because then their legal department has all the work of changing the small little words and making the life of the other peering manager horrible. It sometimes works, it sometimes doesn't. In case it doesn't work, why don't you tell the other party, oh yes, it's nice, but your peering contract, but our legal department is so overworked. Why don't we just set up the peering? We will take care that the peering contract is signed, but we can start peering right away. And in 50% of the cases, nobody ever again asked for us to sign this peering contract. So it gives you a peering, peering contract in itself, they're not a bad thing. They're not a bad thing. I'm not saying that they are really bad, but they don't help you to get de-peered or not to get de-peered. I've never heard of a court case based on a peering contract, at least not with small providers or medium-sized providers. But I think they are quite useless. If you want to stop peering with someone, just do it. There is always a bailout clause in the contract, so you can always get out. But they just keep the legal people busy and don't help you in your day-to-day life. Do you have any questions?
Is this Aaron? Yep.
Hi, Aaron Hughes. Wolfgang, thanks very much for putting this together. It's nice to have a reminder, and love to see it in NANOG as well. I just wanted to emphasize a point. The half a slide in there that said use PeeringDB is quite important. Please spend some time there. It is the only neutral open place to update information about your locations and IP addresses. We're currently working on quite a few tool suites that we'll release to the public. There's one peering tool that helps to automate implementation. But there are a few tool suites we're working on to automate IRR updates, as well as selecting contact information to email your peers rather than just emailing the entire peer list. Some of the reasons people don't do these, I hear, are just because it's not easy, and we're going to try and make it easy. But the data has to be accurate in Peering DB for this to work. Please, please take the time to update the records. One notable point on V6 is that every network I've seen writes their V6 address in Peering DB in a different way. And it would be really nice if everybody would please take the IP address that you get and compress it and put it in correctly instead of random numbers of zeros and colons.
Yeah. Shortly to answer that, there is a second part of this presentation when I give this presentation internally, which is called Peering Tools, and it focuses very much on Peering DB.
Do you guys publish tools publicly?
I can send you the presentation the next time I give it, because I always update it every other month.
Fantastic. Thank you.
It's time for one more question.
One small bit about be professional about things. Don't do your public peering negotiations on public mailing lists like the exchange point lists that you have to connect to.
Good point.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Wolfgang. So in summary, be nice and use Peering DB. Okay, we're going to have the world premiere now of a film. So popcorn at the back of the room. Do you want to introduce the film?
So just a little bit of background to this. About 2 years ago, actually, we had a EuroX forum. It was in Amsterdam. And a couple of people were discussing that there were, they'd been watching a movie called Warriors of the Net. Maybe some people here will know it. And we were saying to each other that, hey, there is actually not something online, a movie that explains what an internet exchange actually is. And let's see if we can set that right. So we contacted these people of Warriors of the Net, and they gave us, humongous figures of how to change that movie into something that would explain an internet exchange. So we thought of something else and wrote out a competition for professionals and amateurs in filmmaking to develop this movie for us. And we started this out about a year ago, I guess, maybe a little bit longer. Wrote out the competition. We got about 20 responses that were interested in actually developing it. Then from those, we chose a subset. And after the first phase, we clearly had a favorite already. And in the end, this favorite won. And this is the end result. And it's actually, I'm very happy with it.
When you use the internet, what happens? Whether you go online to chat with a friend, or send mail, or buy a book, or check the weather, watch a movie, or study the Peloponnesian War, it feels like there's one wire connecting you directly to the thing you want. But a billion other people are connecting to a billion other things at the same time. How does that happen? It's really about making agreements. Think of networking as a game. It only works if we agree to play by the same rules. Otherwise, it's not much fun. If you can get two or more computers to play together, you have a network. If your friend can do it too, there's another network. But if you both agree that your networks will play the same way, now you can hook the two together. You have an inter-network. The rules we play by are called the Internet Protocol. And as long as we all agree, we can keep adding more devices and more networks until the whole world is connected. That's what the internet is, a network of networks that share each other. Every device on the internet has its own unique address. Anything you send via internet is really just a message from one device to another. but it doesn't travel in one big block. It gets pulverized into tiny packets of data, each one wrapped with info about what it is, where it came from, and where it's going. This way, your one message can actually take several different paths to its destination. Then, by following the protocol, the receiving device knows how to put it all back together. The strength of the internet is that it's decentralized. With so many possible connections, there is no single point of failure. If one path gets overloaded or broken, your data just takes a different path. Even if a big chunk of the internet gets wiped out, your message can still find its way. But let's say you use one internet provider and your friend is on a different one. How does your data really get from one network to the other? Some companies make private connections with each other to exchange traffic. But nowadays, more and more traffic is flowing through what we call internet exchange points. An internet exchange is a place where many different organizations come together to interconnect their technology. There may be access providers, broadcasters, publishers, social network sites, telecom operators. Really, anybody who relies on network traffic can benefit from the exchange. By connecting in a common place, they save costs, and the traffic between them flows faster and much more efficiently. If they want, the exchange members can sell each other passage on their networks. But for providers of similar size, all that buying and selling can get to be more trouble than it's worth. Many of them saw that if they just agree to freely share each other's workload, then everybody's cost goes down and the traffic moves more smoothly. This way of doing things is called peering, and it's making the internet faster and more affordable for everybody. The exchange participants make deals with each other according to mutual benefit, so the peering system tends to regulate itself. It may seem strange for competing companies to give each other anything for free, but if everybody wins, nobody seems to mind. The internet is open, decentralized, and totally neutral. Its intelligence lives at the edge, not in the core. No single organization controls it, and that's why it works as well as it does. By agreeing to cooperate, we all make the internet happen. And that's how the internet happens.
So this is this was a Eurex effort, and it's been supported by a number of the Eurex members that did this as a separate project, and it's now finalized. But everybody within this community can use it as long as it's not for commercial purposes. There will be subtitles to it on the YouTube version. Actually, it's already uploaded currently. So if you Google it on or YouTube it, I guess, you'll find it. It's called The Internet Revealed. And if anyone is interested in actually translating a version, let me know.
Thank you very much, Kara.
Well, I just wanted to add a bit more that Kara didn't want to talk about. But
okay, it's not Josh's fault.
No. I was just letting you guys in because you hung around till the end of the day. That at the end you see all those flashing websites, and I don't know if anyone's seen Fight Club before and knows about that guy that used to put those images in. Well, these guys had a go at that as well when they put in the first change to us, so we had to ask them to take some of the pornography and everything out of those. So it was a bit cheeky of them, but yeah. But on the point of translating. I did upload subtitles, even on if you do YouTube or the Internet Revealed, and you click, if anyone knows how to do the subtitle thing. Now it's just in English. If anyone's keen, it's not that much text to help us out with subtitling in every language, please let me know. I'll send you the text, and you just send it back to me in the format that I've sent it to you, and I'll upload it to YouTube, Bill.
It would have been really good if you guys had run this past the regulatory affairs officers of a few carriers, because there are a couple of things in there that will make real problems if they hit governmental audiences. The idea that peering is somehow a sharing of workload, and the idea that peering involves anyone giving anything for free to anyone else, both of those are pretty substantial mischaracterizations of the peering transaction, and both of them are asking for regulatory intervention where none is needed.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so I don't know if I get any help here in getting my presentation up, or I just have to sit here looking like an idiot for 20 minutes. Probably the latter. Okay, well, I'll introduce myself first. I'm this really short guy called
Serge.
Could do that. I've never done a presentation on my knee. Well, anyway, no. Not this sort. I'm Serge Radovic of the European Internet Exchange Association. Okay, so anyway, UIX is the Association of Internet Exchange Points. Originally, we only had European members, but since 2005, we expanded to invite IXPs from every corner of the world, and that's pretty much happened. Today, we've actually got 48 affiliated IXPs. 39 of those are based in Europe, at about 25 different countries, but we also have a member IXP in Africa. We've got about 5 in Asia and 3 in the States, so it's really becoming quite global. We also have some patrons that not only financially support UIX, but they actually get involved. They come to our meetings, they get on the mailing lists, and they're really part of our community as well. Now, since the last meeting in Amsterdam in May, we've had 4 new affiliates join UIX, 2 of which came out of Italy, FVGIX and VSIX, who made a presentation earlier. And also the second Luxembourg Internet Exchange has also decided to join UIX. And the latest addition was NLIX of the Netherlands, which is a well-established IX that has between 20 and 30 locations in the Netherlands. So with the 2 additions from Italy, we've actually got 6 member IXPs that are based in Italy, and there's a 7th one who's actually coming to our next meeting, so might become a member. One thing that I try and get our members involved in is an automated effort to grab the statistics. What you see here is from 47 IXPs. Now, I said there was 39 in Europe. There's about 32 involved, but we've got IXPs like Netnode, who have 5 separate locations. Nix in Norway also has a few, and so on. So it actually represents 47 separate IXPs in Europe. And this traffic, this 2.9 terabit, makes up about 90% of the 121 IXPs in Europe. So our members pretty much make up the bulk of the European IXP traffic. Looking at Europe as a whole, I'm in contact with probably around 80 to 85 IXPs in Europe. And then I'm able to scrape a few other IXPs. So I think there's estimates on around 10 to 12 of the 121 IXPs. So I think these figures are pretty accurate. So my estimate is 3.15 terabits per second is what is going peak across Europe at the peak point in time. And it's about 60% up on 12 months ago, or over a terabit. So it's still moving. I'm going to go into the traffic a little bit deeper in a minute. What I wanted to do is also compare the European statistics to some of the other regions. Now, admittedly, as I said, I'm in very good contact with probably more than 90% of the European IXPs. but I'm either not, or I don't have the ability or time, resources to be in contact with the rest of the world. So the other regions that you see, USA, for example, I think I look at around 7 or 8 IXPs around the US. So while I feel it's quite representative of the trend there, it's not as accurate as Europe, and same with the other countries and regions. So anyway, Europe and the US still seem to be about head-to-head over the last 12 months, well, August to August, I am talking about here, around 50 to 55%. Asia always seems to lag quite a way behind, and they've done that again this year. And Brazil are over 100%. The PTT guys there have got, I think, 9 separate IXPs, unconnected IXPs in Brazil, and they've got some good traffic stats, so I'm able to keep an eye on those guys. So taking a global average, it's around 50%. So what about comparing 2009 to 2008? I looked at the end of January in 2008 to end of September, and now the same period in 2009. And as you can see, overall, over that 9 month or so period, we're still looking at around 20%. And the graphs look something similar. The big difference is the end of summer increase in traffic, the take up. Usually this occurs around the end of July or at latest the end of August, but this seemed to happen later this year. You see that in 2008, that's not going to work. Well, anyway, you see there's around a 15% increase at the end of July in 2008, sorry, the end of August in 2008, which is compared to only 3.85 this year. So it was a really late take up. But this jump here that you see in 2009 is about 16.5%, so it's really caught up. Now, I'm still predicting around 50 to 55% growth in 2009, so as you can see, in the next 3 months, it's going to be quite a bit of growth in the IXPs in Europe. For the first time, I had a bit of a look at making some projections and predictions on a longer term. I've been taking pretty accurate statistics. These statistics are actually based on 36 IXPs that I've been looking at since around 2003. It's not the whole of Europe, but again, I think it represents the IXP scene in Europe quite well. So putting an exponential trend line against this and going through to 2014, I'm going to put a few euros on the fact that we're looking at aggregate peak traffic at around 40 terabits in Europe at September 2014. So I'll update you next year and tell you if I still believe that's the case. I had a bit of a chat with a couple of the bigger IXPs, AM6 for one, and just comparing the figures I had and their figures, they were actually a little bit higher than this. So I think the 40 terabits will probably be easily achieved. We'll see. So who's causing all this traffic? I now calculate there to be around 5,200 participants at the 121 IXPs in Europe. Every year I get in better and better contact with the IXPs. They also produce better information on their websites. So while I say there's a 15% increase over the last 12 months, you could probably take a 2 to 3% error factor off that because maybe now I've just got a little bit more information and more in my database. So it's probably about a 12, 13% increase. And this has pretty much been the case for the last 4 or 5 years. So the participants are still turning up, new participants are turning up. So around 3,000 or so of those are unique ASNs. And there's at least 780 ASNs that I know of that peer at more than one IXP in Europe. And again, this is probably around a 15% increase over the last 12 months. And from what I can see, there's at least 29 ASNs that are appearing at 10 or more IXPs in Europe. And this number is also growing. Last year, it was around 20, and the year before, a little bit less than that. So those numbers are also increasing. I think in total, these are just the European figures, by the way. So these 5,200 participants are accessible through the URIX ASN database. I guess it's I shouldn't really say it's an alternative to Peering DB. It's a little bit different. the essential difference here is that the ASNs are collected either by myself, who and I go through a lot of the websites, or our members, our 48 members, update this database themselves. So for what those guys update, the information is pretty accurate. For the rest, it's as accurate as the information that's made public by the rest of the IXP. So you can go to our database. Go if you head to the either UIX/resources, or you have a look on our homepage, you'll see the ASN database. If you're looking to see where a particular ASN number turns up, then you can plug it into the search query. You can do the same for name if you want to see what different ASNs that name's going under. And you can also list an IXP and see which ASNs are there. So it's pretty complete. Another little feature that I added some time ago is that if you do click on the ASN, then you will go through to Peering DB. So that's how we've hooked up with each other. And they pay me a euro for every time that it goes through. Okay, so a little bit of news. We hold two meetings a year that we call the UIX Forums. They're invitation-only meetings. They're for our members and our patrons, but we always invite prospective member IXPs to join us as well. We usually have around 100 or so representatives. I'm expecting this time around 40 different IXPs to be at our meeting. We've already got 37 registered, so I think we'll get our record of 40. And we talk about a range of issues from commercial, technical, the route server issues are going to be a bit of a focus this time around, also regulatory. Anything that's IXP specific and focused, we will talk about. We invite a couple of ISPs along just to give their views of what they think of IXPs, but it's pretty much IXPs, vendors, colos only that come to these meetings. If you are interested in knowing more about it, or you feel that you should be invited to come along, then come and approach me, and I'll let you know if we can accommodate you. Our resource section, that's UIX/resources, you'll find a few things there. I've published it to our members, the UIX annual report on European IXPs. That's just a whole about 50 pages of the IXPs in Europe, traffic trends, customers, switches, and all that sort of stuff. They're just reviewing it at the moment, telling me if there's any mistakes. I think they've got about another 2-week review period. Then they'll send it back to me, and then I'll make it public. I've got quite a lot of people on a mailing list. If you are interested, either contact me or just go to UIX/resources, and you'll find it there in a couple of weeks. We also had a crack at IXP BCP, which we'd been working on for a couple of years. Now, this has been made public. Again, if you go to resources, you'll find the link to this. And I've also, through a push from a couple of our Asian member IXPs, tried to make an extensive list of Asia-Pacific IXPs. At the resources section, I've probably got the most comprehensive list, an up-to-date list of European IXPs, where you'll find 121 different IXPs listed and links through to their traffic data. I've now also attempted to do that for the Asia-Pacific region. Obviously, I'm in less contact with those IXPs, but I'm trying to improve that. So have a look at that list. If you see, if you know of some additions or IXPs that don't exist anymore, then feel free to let me know about it. Just a little bit more news. I won't say too much about it, but we are planning to go even more global than we are now. I mean, as I said, since 2005, we've already had members from different continents. This still needs to be discussed and decided by our membership, the next general meeting, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. I'll probably give you a better update at the next RIPE meeting in Prague. The UIX route server initiative, you've heard that mentioned from a few of the IXPs. This is something that seems to be getting quite a bit of buzz at our community and a lot of IXPs involved. And I believe that Nick is going to give an update on that after this, so I'm not really going to go into it. And the UIX film competition, we have a winner, which you just saw, so obviously no more information there. I think that's about all I had to update you guys with, so I don't know if there's any questions.
Any questions for Serge? No? I think you've been let off the hook.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Now, Nick is going to update, as promised by Serge, Nick is going to update us on the status of the root server refreshment project or improvement project. Standing in for John, who's as demonstrated by the lack of beard.
Great. Thank you very much, Andy. John Suter was originally planning to give this talk, but unfortunately wasn't able to come to RIPE 59, so I've agreed to give this talk instead of him. So just as a brief background, yes, root servers have become enormously more popular over the past couple of years in the IXP community, as the number of IXP participants has grown very substantially. Pretty much until a couple of months ago, the only realistic BGP daemon that could actually provide fully functional root server functionality was Quagga. Now, I gave a presentation at the last RIPE on why exactly this was so. It's got to do with multiple ribs, multiple views, and all that sort of stuff. So. The problem is that Quagga was not really designed with this sort of thing in mind, and it has very substantial scaling problems, which some of the larger internet exchanges have found out to their detriment. The problems that we've been seeing have been, daemons crashing, sessions being reset, routing flaps, all of that sort of stuff. And it's not really a sort of a good thing to present a service like that to your customers. A bunch of us who are all members of URIX just decided to, get together to try and sort out this problem. We had a bunch of options. There's an awful lot of pent-up angst and verging on hatred of Quagga in the IXP community. A lot of it is actually quite well justified. We had a couple of options in terms of alternatives. The first is Bird, which is development by Nix.cz. And recently, now Andre is in the room somewhere or other. Anyway, maybe Andre isn't in. Oh, yes, there he is. Anyway, Andre does really cool stuff with Bird. Really lovely, configuration system. The project had been sort of very much frozen over the past couple of years, but the recent activity in terms of root servers, kicked the guys in the Charles University into action, and it is now in operation as a root server in one or two exchanges around the place. OpenBGPD was one of the other options. It's been on the block for a little bit longer. Everybody knows it. It's part of the OpenBSD project. It didn't have multiple ribs, and AMSIX have funded development of a multiple rib view system for OpenBGPD, and I believe that they're going to be implementing a live OpenBGPD-based root server system fairly shortly.
Next Thursday.
There didn't really seem to be a whole lot of other options at a couple of months ago when we started looking at this. We had the option also of sort of just trying to dissect Quagga, seeing what the story was. Do you do a sort of a general thing, try and get the source fed back into the Quagga Git repository? Or do you sort of fork off a branch for the IXPs? It wasn't really clear what the best thing could be done. One of the things which was causing really serious problems was for Quagga based IXPs was that every so often fat fingers would cause extra prefixes to be injected into the root servers, and everybody does it, the large carriers as well as the small, the largest carriers as well as the smallest, and everybody else in between. And it caused Quagga an awful lot of trouble because sessions would get reset if you had max prefixes, and then if you didn't have max prefixes set, well then, you know, you'd send the CPU spinning because you'd have all sorts of problems and delays and stuff like that. Anyway, that there was all sorts of problems there. At INEX, we took a decision on day one to implement inbound route filtering using the IRRDB stuff, and that's actually been a major win in this regard. We can do that quite easily because we're very small. Larger IXPs cannot do that easily because they are very large, and when they try to do that sort of thing, they run into all sorts of scaling problems that we simply don't have. So this was a bit of a problem for them. The other option, of course, which was being talked about, was, well, look, you know, hang the whole bloody lot of them. Let's just write our own daemon from scratch. Really tempting, actually, if you've been working with Quagga long enough. So, HeroIX seemed to be the best sort of forum for doing this. It was a good way of, you know, just getting all of the interested IXPs together. We made the astounding realization that unless somebody was actually from the IXP community was actually going to go out and fix these problems, they weren't actually going to be fixed. It seems quite, you know, remarkably dumb in retrospect, but, you know, hey. So what have we done? Well, we've established a root server database, which I'll show you in a few moments. It's a very simple thing, but it's actually quite useful. We have a virtual working group of remote participants. We've gone around to all of the EuroIX members and beaten on the door and demanded money, preferably up front, in use fivers. We published a request for proposals for fixing some of the more glaring problems with Quagga. And we've evaluated a bunch of responses to the RFP, and we have accepted a particular Quagga improvement project. And of course, the first thing now that we've realized is that having done this is that testing is the major problem, because you can't, I mean, if you run Quagga on its own, you know, it seems to be okay. It's only when you start, you know, sort of connecting it into, I don't know, 100 or 150 root server clients that it really starts burping in a rather unseemly manner. And we've also considered funding other non-Quagga projects outside. This is in addition to the funding that AMSIX has made available to the OpenBGPT project. This is the root server database. It's very very quick and easy, really, but it's remarkably useful. It's hosted on the EuroIX website. It's not actually available to the public, but you know, all of the EuroIX members can see what everybody else is running. So here are just a few of them. You can see that, you know, people are using CVS versions and head versions. For OpenBGPD, that's quite useful. The project to fix Quagga, the most important aspect of this, we figured, was, well, you know, if we fork it off, it's just going to suffer bit rot and then it will die. So it's very important strategically for us to get this into the mainstream Git repository. We're currently working with a developer and doing an awful lot of profiling, just by way of figures and all of that sort of stuff. In the first week, he took the startup time for reading and processing one of the IXP configurations from 15 minutes down to 52 seconds, which is quite good. It's got to do with data structures. If you use the wrong data structures in your code, the performance will be complete trash. And we've identified a lot of areas in the code where this was the case. So hopefully, once we've got the testing rig up and running, we can then start doing some really serious performance improvement. We also received a rather interesting proposal for a completely new root server from a it's from an existing code base. It's not a full BGP daemon or anything like that, and it's not a fully featured BGP daemon for what it does, but it claims to be very, very fast indeed. And EuroIX has agreed in principle to fund a proof of concept, which is to say that it should be able to read and process a configuration file very fast indeed, and it should be able to handle a specified number of root server clients and do all of that stuff really fast. The proof of concept is IPv4 only, 16-bit ASNs only. Once the proof of concept has been agreed and we're happy with it, things like IPv6 and ASN32s and all that sort of stuff will be implemented. They're relatively easy. It's not a major problem. The working title of the project is Bogart, and I've spent about 10 or 15 minutes looking through my emails because last night to try and remember what in the hell this stood for, but unfortunately I can't, so maybe at the next RIPE meeting I'll manage to find it. So this is where we hope to be relatively shortly. We should have a much improved Quagga. It won't be perfect because Quagga has some design issues which will require an awful lot of fairly deep surgery to fix. We have Bird, which is working and I believe working very nicely. We have OpenBGPD, which is showing an awful lot of promise, and we have Bogart. They're all fit for multilateral peering deployment, or at least should be relatively shortly. So there you go. That's what we've been doing. Any questions?
Again, no questions. Okay.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Okay. We've got a couple more talks now. We've got Martin from the M6 who's going to describe how to rebuild a plane in midair, presumably with an internet exchange in the middle of it afterwards. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's actually not my title. I think Mike came up with it first, but I'm not really sure. But anyway, what I would like to tell you is basically how we went from this to this without this. So we started off with some preparation. About a year ago, this whole thing started, and we started to look into VPLS. So the first thing we did was debug Brocade's MPLS code. It was horrible at that time. I think we found about 30 bugs, small to serious, and well, we tested this extensively. We went to Brocade a couple of times in the US to test in their lab, and they were very helpful and actually resolved everything, and they added a couple of features that we needed. So then we built some new software. On the old platform, we had some software that reacted on SNMP traps generated by VSRP events. Because we were going to disable VSRP, we needed to write new software, so we did that. We developed configuration generation tools. Our new platform has a couple of hundred LSPs, a couple of hundred MPLS paths, and we'll probably run into the thousands at some point. So we describe the whole network in XML, and we generate our configurations from that. Then we moved our access switches for 1GigE customers behind our access switches for 10GigE customers. More on that in a little bit. We replaced some hardware because we were running with some Brocade RX switches, which do not support MPLS. And finally, we defined a migration scenario to actually do the actual migration and merge the platform and without customer impact. So first thing we did was connect the access switches for 1GigE customers behind the photonic switches we have. We use Glimmer Glass photonic cross connects, which are basically electronic patch panels. And the problem we had is that we wanted to migrate one half of the network to MPLS first, one half and the other half later. So we couldn't use VSRP anymore. Also, when we move these edge switches behind the photonic cross connects, there would be no more physical connection between the two core switches, so there would be no way that these switches could talk VSRP to each other. So then we disabled VSRP. We had to install a different kind of software, which basically reacted on link flaps. When a link flapped in an active network, the SNMP trap for that was received by the software, and a topology failover was initiated, and all the photonic switches would swap their connections. So yeah, we did that. We moved the access switches behind the photonic cross connects, so they act as a normal 10 gig E customer, and we adapted the software. Then we migrated one half of the platform to MPLS. We started with load balancing over two core switches, just to test if the whole load balancing thing would work all right. And we did that for about a month. I think it was 5 weeks in total. And then we did the second half. So then we ended up with two separate MPLS platforms. Actually, so at this stage, that was in August, I believe, we had two separate MPLS platforms, both with two core switches. So that already solved our scaling issue because we could scale to all the ports on both core switches. But we also wanted to fix the problem of doing complete platform failovers because that introduced too much problems. So what we wanted to do is merge the both platforms into a full platform in one single active platform. Of course, we had to do this without any customer impact. We needed to do all sides together, and we needed to keep the time between having a completely working platform and a completely working backup platform as short as possible. And so yeah, we had to come up with something to do that all in one maintenance window, or at least something close to that. So this was the initial situation. This is a close-up of our core infrastructure. We connect all the access switches to a large photonic cross connect at a core site, and from there all the links go to the different core switches. We have a red and a blue network, and we start with the red network active. What we did then is reduce the capacity on the blue network to 50% of the load so that we could take out half the links. We then have to wait till about 1 in the morning until the traffic levels of our platform went down enough so that we could actually run on this reduced blue network. So yeah, we really had to sit and wait till that finally was the case. So that was 1 in the morning, and then we swapped over to the blue network. From then on, we had about 6 hours to bring the blue network back to full capacity, because at 7 in the morning, traffic starts to pick up again, people are waking up, so you really don't want to do any maintenance anymore then. So what we did was we took half of the links from the red network, we simply swapped them around on the access side. On the core PXC, on the photonic cross connect, we did some reshuffling. That's basically a web interface with clicking this port goes there and that port goes there. It's really easy, no plug-in cables on site. So we added all of the half of the links from the red network to the blue network, added all the LSPs and the MPLS paths, and finally added the LSPs to the VPLS instances on the blue network. And we can all do this transparently without any customer noticing. So at 7 in the morning, we were pretty much done with this, and we had a blue network at full capacity again. And at the same time, we did the same on the red network. We took half of the links of the blue network that we took out earlier, added them to the red network, put on MPLS path, LSPs, etc., etc. What you see at the bottom is that from each photonic switch, there goes a link from the blue network to each core switch and from the left red network. So we basically split the original aggregated link in half. So at this point, we had two completely redundant, we had still actually two networks, but now they were all using all four core devices. And we didn't have automatic failovers yet. We could do manual failovers at that point. So if there would have been a problem, then we could have fixed that just a little longer than normally. But at this point, it was 7 a.m. already, so we really couldn't do any more intrusive, potentially intrusive maintenance. So we went to sleep. And then the next day, we started adding LSPs from the red network to the blue network. Well, previously red and previously blue, because we're now building one entire network. So if you have the two switches at the top, we added LSPs and MPLF paths between those switches so that all access switches were active at the same time. And then we enabled a tool called PXCD, which basically works the same as the previous tools we used. It reacts on SNMP traps, only this one reacts on SNMP traps about LSP failures instead of link flaps or VSRP failures. And finally, we distributed all 10Geek e-customers over the different access switches so that all the access switches were active at the same time. And that is where we are now. This took two more nights of playing, but nobody noticed. So that was basically it. We did a successful migration of the platform. The only thing customers saw was one or two link flaps. And most people, for most routers, that means no flapping BGP sessions. For some it does. But we also had that with the old platform with the VSRP failovers, so that was acceptable. The total time for this project was less than 11 months. We started end of October last year with our first conversations with Brocade. And early September this year, we did the actual migration, or we finished it. The whole merge of the platform was done in three consecutive maintenance windows. And we had about 12 hours where we did not have a completely full network at full capacity. But it was always at enough capacity to handle the load at that point. And of course, we had no customer impact. And the main thing here is that we could really not have done this without our Glimmer Glass photonic switches, because it would simply have been A, too much work to physically replug everything. We would have needed a lot more people, and B, things like a failover, you can do that a lot faster by just instructing everything at once to repatch and then doing it by hand. So that's it about the migration. Now, there was a talk I did a couple of days ago about operational problems we saw on the platform. There was one operational problem that I didn't mention yet, and that is what we call our boxes now. We used to call them switches, but now they talk MPLS and they do routing. And do we call them routers now? I don't know. Routers. Oh, shut up, you stupid Brit. Well, they do something with labels. So I thought more like something like a label writer. And then you get a network like this. Anyway, questions?
Thanks very much, Martin. No questions at all?
Yeah.
Everyone must be super hungry already. Okay, thank you again. Last scheduled set of slides are now from Remco, who's going to be talking about Equinix's new carrier Ethernet exchange product. Thank you.
So, how does Olaf do this? I am being forced to stand here by powerful people in smoky back rooms. I didn't plan on doing this presentation, and like you, I'd rather be somewhere else right now. But this is not the secret working group. Thank God they only show up once each meeting. So instead, I'm going to talk to you about our new Ethernet exchange platform. What does it do? And that all came into play because of this press release. As you can see, that was Tuesday. In the parallel but not entirely disconnected world called ITU, we made an announcement in Geneva. They also have a meeting this week that we're going to develop our first carrier neutral Ethernet exchange. And of course, that raised a few eyebrows and a few questions in this audience, what the hell that was. So I'll try to help you out there. First, a brief history of carrier Ethernet. Warning here, there's some artistic license. I'm making some very awful shortcuts. Don't come running to microphones if you feel that I'm not entirely representing history 100% correct. So, but here's an attempt. So, back in the 1990s, where it's carrier and Ethernet fit together like honest and politician, carriers wanted to have nothing to do with Ethernet. It was a kind of mediocre technology, a LAN technology, not even a good one. Is a quote I remember from those days. You can't even route or assign addresses. Interesting. Why that was important, I still don't know. Which at the turn of the century raised the question, well, why are our customers asking for this stuff these days? I have no idea. It's a poor technology. Why would they? Moving past 2001, dot-com bust, out of money, the interesting question was, why do these people pay 10 times less for their equipment? And so after 2001, the Metro Ethernet Forum came into life, which basically was redo all the carrier things using Ethernet as a protocol instead of whatever we're having right now. So how did that develop? First thing they did was set up a new standards body, as they do. Second thing they did was deal with the quality aspects. So they introduced the world to fantastic things like 2 megabit Ethernet, 34 megabit Ethernet. When they had that sorted out, they dealt with the UNI, or as we call them, CPEs, which is, well, how do we interface with the customer? What do we want and what do they want? That's been pretty much sorted out in fantastic protocols called Dying Gasp, and I don't know, it's really interesting stuff if you're inclined to read it. And the next step the Metro Ethernet Forum really is at right now is dealing with NNIs, or in other words, how do carriers talk to each other using Ethernet or delivering Ethernet. And so what's this NNI anyway? I took this off Wikipedia. A network-to-network interface, or NNI for short, is an interface which specifies signaling and management. Read the web page. It's a lot of complicated language for, big surprise, peering. Not necessarily settlement-free, but it is peering nonetheless. So what's an Ethernet exchange then? It's not an internet exchange using Ethernet. We all know those. An Ethernet exchange. Well, Ethernet is relatively easy. Carrier Ethernet is harder by nature. Inter-domain carrier Ethernet is a challenge. And multiple inter-domain carrier Ethernet is complicated. So the Ethernet exchange basically is just an effort to scale NNIs, so links between networks, from a one-to-one solution. You really must envision that carrier A has a box in a rack, and there is a cable going to another box in another rack from another carrier, and those two boxes are used for connecting those two networks. They're not used for anything else. The Ethernet exchange is an effort to scale this and go from a from that model to so private interconnects to a shared platform like the ones we've been used to for a decade and a half in the internet environment. It's not just forwarding packets. That would be too easy. There's a lot of stuff in carrier Ethernet that you need to look at. You need to translate identifiers like QTAC, QNQ. You have quality definitions, class of service bits, DSCPs, which not all carriers might treat identically. You've got SLAs to take into account what service am I providing to what customer, and what guarantees am I giving, and what's the other carrier doing, et cetera, et cetera. So an absolute metric boatload of standards comes into play, 802.1, P, Q, AD, AG, AH, QAY, DSCP mappings, MPLST, VPLS, VLLs. And this is hard stuff. And even the carriers don't know really yet what they want from a service like this. So we're doing a pilot right now together with Alcatel-Lucent. They have a very complicated box that can do super complicated things with Ethernet packets. We're giving it a try. We're trying to establish what the community wants out of a service like that right now. One of the things I can say to you, and this will probably surprise you, is that the traffic that goes on between carriers on Ethernet is a lot less than you would think. So even though Martin just had a presentation about being able to trunk 128 10 gig ports all together, this is the world where a 1 gig interface still counts as a big interface. And with that, that's really it. There's nothing really more to say since it's all still a work in progress, but if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Thank you, Remco. The mic's looking a bit empty. I've got one. So what do you think the future, do you think there's a significant future in this particular model for internetwork, interconnectivity from today, or do you think it will still happen across hard layer 3 boundaries as we normally do it on internet exchanges?
Well, I think we'll see a couple of separated worlds for a while. You could perfectly run an internet exchange on top of an Ethernet exchange, as in the same way you could deliver milk in a Ferrari. So you could do it, but it makes little sense to do so if you look at port density, cost per port of the switching platform required to do a carrier Ethernet exchange. That has a very significantly different price point, complexities, responsibilities for the operator of such an exchange are also quite different. So I think, the whole concept as it is as yet unproven. The Metro Ethernet Forum has published that they probably would like some neutral third parties to sit in the middle between carriers and facilitate this exchange of NNIs. But what that exactly will amount to is as yet unsure.
Okay, thank you. Right, we're currently 30 minutes ahead of time, aren't we? Oh, it's nope. The official's finishing time. Oh, sorry, no, we are bang on time then. We're 1 minute ahead of time. So thank you very much for attending EIX. I hope that was useful. And we'll see you at the Ripe Dinner later, hopefully. Thank you.
the new thing.